Fucking love baseball. Beer drinking.
Drunken ideas that come to fruition.
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to Pitch Sequence, a podcast about the People's Baseball League based out of New Orleans, formed in 2016. We will be recording from the historic 7th Ward of New Orleans. Our goal is to do some storytelling, some documenting about our league, the People's Baseball League, and hopefully our stories are interesting enough that even if you don't like baseball, you'll stick around and listen to what we have to say. In this episode, we have Mike Parker of the Rougarou, who will answer the question, when did baseball start in New Orleans? We will also have Becky Muma, who will answer the question, when did the People's Baseball League start? I hope you enjoy. Right, I'm here with Michael Parker of the Rougarou in the People's Baseball League, and how are you doing today, Mike?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Really good. Really good. There was some flooding yesterday, but it seemed to mostly dried out. The shoes are dry, so feeling good today.
And we're 2 days removed from opening day of the...
That's right.
Fall baseball season for the People's Baseball League.
That's right. Underway. A brand new team, Bayou St. John Blues. But yeah, 3 games under, they're in the books. And despite the threats of rain and potential for monsoon rain, which did come on Monday, but we adhered to not following the weather forecast. And that worked out.
Worked out fantastically. The Rougarou lost to S9 6-4 in the first game. It was, despite being on the losing side, it was a great game, competitive all the way. I would say that the Rougarou picked up where we left off last season, which was an improvement on the beginning of the season. Mm-hmm. So we're still working out some kinks, some mental errors, but we had a lot of fun, got just great team spirit, team unity, and it's going to be a fun season.
Yes. There's a lot of good spirit on the Rougarou, and I was a good vibe over there in the dugout. That's what I was sensing from my end. And a 6-4 ball game, that's good hitting, good pitching, good defense, interesting all the way to the end. That's a great baseball game.
Oh, it was. We had some bases loaded situations that we were not able to capitalize on fully. So we'll be working on our clutch hitting as the season goes on. Added a couple of players who did some great relief pitching for us. That was an issue at times last season, so mm-hmm. So the rest of y'all better watch out.
Here come the Rougarou. Great. Well, I want to get into a little bit of your history as a baseball player. I know you've played in many forms, and baseball's been a part of your life for a very long time.
Oh, it has. I'm 51, and so it's been a part of my life for over 40 years. And I would say that there were 3 major currents to it when I was young, and they pretty much all happened simultaneously. It was playing Little League ball, becoming a baseball fan, and collecting baseball cards. They basically all happened at the same time. I'm a Louisiana native, originally from around Shreveport, which is where both of my parents are from. And when I was young, there was just a 2-year period where we lived outside of Louisiana. that was basically 1977 to 79, and we were living in Reisterstown, Maryland, just outside of Baltimore. So I started playing Little League ball at that time and became a fan of the Baltimore Orioles at a just fabulous time for that, because those were years when they were, they just had this intense rivalry with the Yankees and the Red Sox. You think of the Yankees and Red Sox having an intense rivalry, but at that time, not so much today, but at that time, the Orioles were very much in the mix. I mean, Earl Weaver was always the manager, whereas the Red Sox and Yankees would kind of go through managers, but there was a time, I mean, you talk about Earl Weaver, Billy Martin, and Don Zimmer as the managers of those three teams, and you're talking about just colorful, flamboyant personalities, brilliant analytical minds, of which I would argue Weaver was the greatest of the three, just as a pure baseball manager. And then there was the baseball card collecting, which in those pre-internet days, if you were like I was, the baseball fan who was obsessed with the statistics, with the numbers of the game, you had your daily paper.
Yes.
You had publications like the Sporting News that would come out weekly that published a lot of stats. And you had baseball cards, and those were where you would create this kind of mythology of numbers. And so the baseball cards were a very crucial part of that. And the other side of it was that you didn't have cable TV. You didn't have games every night. You had a game of the week. You had Monday night baseball, but otherwise, a lot of the visual experience of the game was going to be, again, through the paper publications, but through the baseball cards also. I mean, if you were to name a player from that time, I would probably get a mental image of their baseball card. You know, wow. If you named Jim Rice or Dave Parker.
Is it a young Cal Ripken at that time?
Not quite late 70s. That would have been early 80s.
Early 80s, okay. And were you listening to baseball games?
I don't remember listening to baseball games. That's something I definitely came to later. But I don't remember radio being a big part of my baseball experience. I remember Monday night baseball. I remember seeing a Nolan Ryan no-hitter on Monday night baseball.
Wow.
He was pitching for the California Angels.
Wow.
And I remember a play in the outfield that, if he didn't have a no-hitter, definitely would have been a score to hit. But the outfielder took a dive for the ball and didn't quite make it. But I don't think there was anyone watching that who would have taken issue with the official scorekeeper calling that an error rather than a hit, just to preserve the no-hitter.
Yeah.
And it probably, at that time, it was probably the third or fourth of, I think, the seven that he threw over the course of his career.
That's amazing. Seven no-hitters for, what, three or four different teams?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are starting with the origin story of the People's Baseball League, but we thought before we even get into that, we should talk about the origin story of baseball in New Orleans. And I was the comandante commissioner of the People's Baseball League, founder of the People's Baseball League, and was asked to make a timeline or come up with the history of the league, and I couldn't figure out where to start because I wanted, do you start in 2016 when we started playing pickup ball, or when baseball started in New Orleans, or with humanity? So I chose to go with humanity. And this is a bit of an assumption, but I'm just going to go for it. And the first date that I had was thousands of years ago, that humans started playing with sticks and rocks recreationally. And once I figured out a starting point, I was able to move forward. So that took a while. It took a couple of months, actually. I stalled on that. And then eventually, after figuring that part out, started to document the People's Baseball League's history. But we're going to go back to when did baseball start in New Orleans? And Mike Parker here is going to give us a little rundown of when baseball started in New Orleans.
Okay, so to start off, the information I'm drawing from is the work of S. Derby Gisclair, a local writer who writes on the subject. He's published, I'm drawing from two different books of his, Baseball in New Orleans, which was published in 2004, and then Early Baseball in New Orleans, which was just published this year. It's a brand new book. He also has one about the history of Tulane baseball. And he's also written extensively about the history of boxing in New Orleans. So as far as I know, that's his book publishing history. But according to him, the origin of baseball in New Orleans is pretty much current with the origin of baseball as we know it in the 1840s. And it seems like it really did not take much time for it to become a national pastime, if not the national pastime. And especially with the Civil War, that just jump-started the dissemination of in both the North and the South pretty much concurrently. And so what's interesting about the history of baseball in New Orleans, and particularly he tends to focus on professional baseball in New Orleans. And what's interesting is, and it probably shouldn't be too surprising, is there so many oddball kind of firsts associated with baseball in New Orleans. A lot of people, I think, know that the Cincinnati Red Stockings were the first professional baseball team in 1869. Well, already in 1870, they came to New Orleans.
Wow.
And so a 5-game schedule was arranged with local New Orleans baseball teams, which
multiple teams?
Oh, there were multiple teams. So this is approximately 25 years after the game was created. And I think it's also important to say that there have been rules changes over the years, but if you were to go back to the 1850s and see a baseball game, you would recognize what you were watching. So in 1870, the Cincinnati Red Stockings come to New Orleans. They have a 5-game schedule between April 25th and April 30th. And S. Derby Gisclair found the scores of these games. The 1870 Cincinnati Red Stockings beat the Pelicans 51-1, the Southerns 79-6.
Wow.
The Atlantics 39-6, and then finally the last two games were a little bit more competitive. They beat the Lone Stars 26-7, and the Robert E. Lee's 24-4.
The Robert E. Lee's 24-4. Wow!
So that's 1870.
Robert E. Lee had a baseball team named after him.
That's right.
Not surprised.
There's a flip side to that as well. So also in 1870, so a year after the first professional baseball team, you have the first spring training camp happens in New Orleans. And it's the Chicago White Stockings.
Wow.
So,
because this is a great place to have spring training.
Right.
The weather's fantastic. Festival season, baseball season.
So you can basically play year-round. I mean, there's the rain, but the overall climate and temperature are very conducive to it for teams coming from Chicago, Cincinnati, New York, what have you. So the first spring training happens in New Orleans. Also, the first detachable rain check happens in New Orleans. Now, that, again, I mean, that probably makes sense. So I'll just read directly from. In baseball's early days, heavy cardboard tickets were sold and turned in at the end of the game so they could be used again. Fence jumpers started joining the paying customers in line seeking tickets for a later game after a rainout. And Pelican player-manager Abner Powell, who is a very crucial figure in New Orleans baseball, noticed that the team was issuing more rain checks than tickets they had sold. He developed the idea of a perforated rain check stub, a practice that is still used on virtually all event tickets today. And he comes up with that in 1889.
Wow, and fence jumpers haven't figured it out since then. Still trying. Oh, that's great. So if you were to put a year on it, it would be 1840s.
Yes, right.
And prior to that, it was cricket.
Right, yeah.
So probably post...
Which Louisiana, was very popular.
Yeah, post-Louisiana Purchase to the 1840s, cricket was the most popular sport in New Orleans.
So I mentioned Abner Powell.
Yes.
Who was... an outfielder, pitcher, and the manager of the New Orleans Pelicans, going back to 1887, as well as the detachable rain check, he is also credited with the canvas tarp to pull out during rain. Again, there were so many innovations that are rain-based in New Orleans. And he's also credited with establishing Ladies' Day, so with making an effort to bring women to the ballpark as fans, so that was Abner Powell. And
what about Thirsty Thursday? I imagine that's New Orleans.
Oh, probably.
Yeah. If we dig a little deeper,
right? It may be you were talking about. How far back the stick and ball?
Right back.
You know, maybe some archaeologists will find Thirsty Thursday back in the Neolithic era.
Right.
You know, but probably in New Orleans.
Yeah.
You know?
I need to go back to Poverty Point. Answers are somewhere in there.
So
okay, great. Well, I think that answers the question when baseball begun. Do you want to add anything else to the origin story?
The only thing I'd like to add, and this comes from Gisclair's more recent book, is a little bit about the history of African American baseball, mm-hmm. which also goes back to the 19th century. And as far back as 1875, New Orleans teams were holding an organizing convention for what was then the National Association of Baseball Players to facilitate membership by black teams. Mm-hmm. So this 1875, this is at the tail end of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. So more than most places, New Orleans did have integrated... a kind of integrated culture.
Absolutely, yeah. Institutions, government for a very brief period of time, but during Reconstruction, this was going on. And so what you're saying is it's also happening in baseball.
It was also happening in baseball.
Wow.
Just to list a list of some of the clubs that were active, The Pickwick, and what's also interesting is all of, in all of these, baseball is two words. So the Pickwick Baseball Club was considered to be the, quote, colored champion, unquote, of New Orleans for many years, and was active from 1869 through the turn of the century, into the 20th century.
The Pickwick Baseball Club?
The Pickwick Baseball
not,
Club.
Not to be confused with the Pickwick Club, which is a super racist organization that also had the members that were part of Comus, which was a Mardi Gras parade.
Oh, really?
And also part of the Crescent City White League. So that's, wow.
Interesting.
Interesting wording going on there.
Also active in 1872 were the Aetna Baseball Club, the Democrats Baseball Club, the Franklin Baseball Club, and in 1888, the PBS Pinchback Baseball Club, named for the African-American governor of Louisiana during Reconstruction.
This is a true story. He has a fantastic beard, and I have printed out Pinchback's beard, and I take it to the barber, and I ask him, give me the Pinchback. True story.
And then just one other one to mention, the Walter L. Cohen Baseball Club was organized in 1885 from the remnants of the former Pickwick Baseball Club by their second baseman, Walter L. Cohen. Cohen was a free man of color at his birth in 1860 and a successful businessman when he became involved in baseball. He would later become immersed in statewide Republican politics, becoming one of the few blacks to hold appointed office in Louisiana during the 20th century. So again, post-Reconstruction, and at a time when the segregationist Democratic Party dominated Louisiana politics, the only way that Republicans could hold any kind of office was as an appointed office. And this was an African-American in the early 20th century who was holding appointed office in Louisiana. And one of the instrumental individuals in 19th century baseball in New Orleans.
And there's a high school named after him, Cohen High School in Uptown.
All right. Yeah. So, you know, the intersections of baseball and the larger culture and politics go back to its beginnings.
Yep, absolutely. Great. Thanks, Mike. All right, I am here with Becky Muma, and we are here to talk about the origin of the People's Baseball League. The question is, when did it begin? How did it begin? And I want to start, Becky, with your relationship to baseball.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about how you were introduced to baseball and your general relationship to baseball.
All right.
As it is.
I don't remember being introduced to baseball. It was more something that was in the background of my life. I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, so my family was Cleveland Indians fans. And my dad was, like, the biggest Cleveland fan in the world.
I would argue still is.
Still might be, yeah. It's a cycle of hope and devastation every single year in the Muma household and has been for my entire memory. And I played softball growing up. And I think the really formative year of softball was when I turned 14 and it stopped being like the, you know, everybody plays, it's just sort of fun kid competition and you had to try out for a team. And we all had to go to this big gym and play catch and bat and pitch, and run, sprints, and I was put on an expansion team along with everyone else who didn't quite make the cut. So it's not like they took all the kids who didn't quite make the cut and, like, spread them out on the other teams. They put them all on one new team. So we were all, for the first year, playing softball where you were allowed to steal, like, all these new rules that we weren't used to, And it was competitive. It was fast pitch, and none of us had ever really done that either. So we were, like, underdogs is kind of an overstatement because it kind of implies that people thought we could win anything. So we didn't win that much at the beginning of the year. We had a pretty rough start. There were a lot of, like, really embarrassing moments of girls just, like, not knowing the rules, a lot of, like, getting caught in between the bases and not knowing how to do a rundown, a lot of, like, you know, botched simple plays because we didn't know how to do relays. Our pitching game wasn't that great. I was actually a pitcher, and I remember during tryouts pitching and one of the coaches being like, okay, you can go ahead and throw fast now. And I was like, no, this is just kind of how I throw, which was not fast, but like there was a weird spin on the ball. So eventually I would end up pitching, like kind of coming in the eighth inning, and for one inning, I could probably strike out, like, everyone who came up. And then the next inning, they'd, like, figured out that I just have this one pitch, even though it's kind of weird, and they would smash me. So I was good for, like, one inning. But anyway, that year we ended up, Bergen Realty was the best team in the league. I still remember this. They were brown and orange colored, so the Cleveland Browns colors.
Yes.
And we were Mayo and Orvitz, also a realtor. And we were red, white, and blue. And we somehow made it to the playoffs, and we were playing Bergen Realty to keep going. And we played a great game, and the score was like 7-8, and we were the home team, and we had a runner on third, and we were so close, and it didn't happen. We lost. She got stranded on base. And my dad, I think, recalls, he was an assistant coach, and he recalls this moment a lot more vividly than I do. Apparently it was just like a circle of girls like kind of sitting down and crying near first base, and my dad tried to do the like no tears in baseball line, and it didn't go over very well.
I've watched baseball with your father.
Yeah.
Dan?
Yeah.
Dan. And one of the reactions that he had, which I feel like epitomizes what you just described and, uh-huh. and Cleveland Indians baseball in general,
uh-huh.
is, oh man.
Yeah, yeah. That's a classic Dan line when he's watching Cleveland baseball.
Yeah, I think that sums up a lot of Cleveland sports right there in your personal experience. But
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. So that's your introduction to baseball. So getting into the origin story of the People's Baseball League. This is Adam Cronenberg here. The commissioner, former commissioner of the People's Baseball League, Comandante, and we're going to go back to 2010. You know what? Let's go back even further. 1999. Woo! Old other.
Are you that old?
Yeah, I'm that old. 1999, I was playing soccer freshman year of college, and college, wow. I've been drinking beer, by the way, because I'm trying to bring back some of these memories. There's obviously a flaw within that system. But anyways, 1999, I was in high school. And in 1999, after our soccer season, freshman year of soccer, I tried out for, and you know what, now we're in 2000, new millennium. And I had two ground balls hit to me. They went through the wickets, and I did not make the team. Coach Warren, I'm not going to say the words I'm thinking about for you right now, but you did not take me on the team, and at that point I was done with baseball. So that's 1999. And then we're going to fast forward to didn't play baseball in high school and kind of checked out, and fast forward to 2009, 2010, moved to New Orleans and start teaching, and simultaneously join a softball team, which, you know, it's the gateway to baseball, I think, in some ways, mm-hmm. Especially what we're doing as far as, like, the boozy baseball game. And so I'm playing on the softball team, and the Giants, 2010, start winning baseball games. And as you know, they...
As everyone knows.
As everybody knows, they made it. Through September into October ball, and they happen to be the best team in October, which is all you have to do to win a World Series. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to be the best team in November, too.
True, that's true. You have to make the playoffs and then be the best team in October.
Yeah.
The Dodgers are still figuring that out. They're a great team in May, by the way.
One of the best May teams.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Yeah.
Anyways, they win, and I sort of reignited my baseball love. Started coaching baseball, and, 2012, 2014, they do that thing. They do it again, and it's awesome. And throughout that time, though, I was sort of looking for a baseball outlet beyond softball. And sort of that guilty feeling. I think people who are baseball players who played softball, there's a little guilt involved in that, like, you know, it's not baseball.
Right.
And you kind of want it to be that. I know I wanted it to be that, but also was like, oh, this is really fun smashing the ball around and playing this softball game, but also knowing, like, that's not really what I want to do.
Like,
I really
low-fat ice cream.
Yeah. Totally. Exactly. We know you want that full cream ice cream. And I took a trip to San Francisco, and my sister's boyfriend, so shout out to Daniela, my sister Nella, as we called her growing up, and Gantz, still together. And Gantz was in a league in San Francisco called the Pacific Coast Hardball League, and he's still in it, and they invited me to their all-star game, and it was amazing. I witnessed a bunch of guys playing ball, wooden bats, and was just blown away and absolutely wondering why that doesn't exist in New Orleans, and sort of searched around, and at the time, Eric Lynn just walked in with some Parlo beers.
Pizza.
If Eric, can you pour me a beer, please?
Obviously.
Thank you. And just thought, why doesn't this exist in New Orleans? And sort of, this is 2014. I would complain to my friends that we should have something like this. And I think my friends got tired of me complaining about it, especially when the combination of going to a bar and having a few drinks and complaining about the lack of this sort of a baseball league. And this coalesced into a night at Parlo. Whoop! Rewind. The beers
didn't
are taken
exist.
Out. It's because the Parlo beer is here.
Exist.
I didn't even exist at the time.
No.
It's because Eric just walked in Parlo. Excuse me. Pals Lounge.
The scene that so many things in this world have begun.
February 2016, Pals Lounge. I believe there was thunder and lightning.
Yes.
And Becky, take it over. What happened at Pals Lounge that night?
Well, I mean, that's kind of a steep. Remembering what happened at Pals Lounge the night that something big started is always going to be hard because you're at Pals Lounge. It was definitely stormy, and it was dark, which means we'd probably been there for a while.
Absolutely.
Because Pals is the bar that we could walk to from where we lived with one beer for the walk.
Yeah.
And that was usually done daylight, evening, and it was dark, dark, so we'd been there for a while.
And for those of you that have been to Pals, I want you to imagine walking into Pals, and there's some tables on the right-hand side. Right when you go through the door, you give your ID to the security guard. And we have just been delivered some Parlo beer. What are we drinking? Eric Lynn, please tell us what we're drinking.
Tales from the Sea. It's a farmhouse IPA from Parlo Brewery.
Tales from the Sea, a farmhouse IPA.
It might be Seas from the Tail.
It could be Seas from the Tail from Parlo Brewery. That is guiding this story right now. Anyways, you're walking into Pals Lounge, and it's not the first standing table on the right, but it's the second standing table mm-hmm. on the right, and it was me, Becky, and Hagen.
Mm-hmm. We were probably fresh from the butcher shop.
Oh, yeah.
So we had probably already had some whiskey.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure you did.
And I remember standing outside under the tree.
Tales from the Sea. Delicious.
Correction. Trains across the sea.
Trains across
Eric,
the sea, equally.
You're doing a terrible job. You can edit this out, right?
Second table on the right.
Or under the tree outside.
Under the tree. Oh.
Remember there was a tree on the corner before it like blew over. I remember standing out there and talking about this and having a cigarette.
Wow. Okay. Cigarette break outside. Uh-huh. Wow. I don't remember this.
I mean, it's possible that it was a long conversation that spanned both. But I remember standing outside under the tree and getting very excited. We were all very excited.
But like what?
Well, you had made an announcement. You'd transitioned from ceaselessly complaining that no baseball in New Orleans for adults existed to declaring that you were going to start such a baseball league.
There was a declaration made.
There was a declaration, and it was very firm.
I remember putting my drink down.
There was no doubt.
Yeah.
No questioning. No, maybe I should do it. It was just like, you know what? No one else has done this thing. I'm going to do this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I remember. And then this is February, which is a magical month for me in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of magical things have happened for me. My birthday is in February. And what I remember is I then, feeling the energy, went in and asked a girl out on a date.
Really?
Yes.
I don't remember that at all.
Oh, yes, that did happen.
Oh, man.
She said yes.
Did you go on a date?
That's a whole other story.
Are we gonna disclose her name?
No. Not disclosing her name. She knows who she is. What a night. Fast forward. To the next morning.
I'm going to dip in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We've also got a Pizza Delicious pizza. What kind of pizza do we have, Eric?
Margarita.
Margarita pizza.
Future sponsor, Pizza Delicious.
Parlo Brewery and Pizza Delicious. All right, so fast forward to the next morning.
Nice.
I remember 2016, so Ditto is in my life. My dog's in my life. We went for a walk to the bayou. I remember sitting on the bayou, and I took out my my flip phone. It was just more of a slide phone. It's a Samsung TXT Gravity. It's not a smartphone, but it has capabilities to text anyone.
It's a Wise phone.
And I went through my phone book and I texted everybody that I know that tomorrow, Sunday, so this must have been a Friday night.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Saturday I texted everyone that I knew that might be interested in playing a baseball game. Hey, we're playing on the Greenway.
Mm-hmm.
And bring your glove. We're playing a baseball game. Everyone that I knew texted them. And fortunately, my phone didn't like explode in the mass text. Situation, and then on Sunday, somewhere in the range of 14 to 20 people showed up, and we managed to play a game of baseball.
Yeah,
we'll call it that.
Yeah, of sorts.
Of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I want to highlight a very important thing that we did that I think propelled the whole league. Which is, I don't know whose idea this was, but like, there was a clipboard and paper.
Yeah.
And we took down people's emails. And that's the first time we did that.
Yep.
And we started amassing emails. And not only did we start amassing emails, we sent out weekly detailed updates of the game.
Yeah.
And of how the game went. And what was beautiful about that, and this happened the next week, and the next week, so now we're getting into March,
mm-hmm.
but somehow surpassed carnival season.
Yeah.
Into March. and not very many people from the original game showed up, but at this time I would like to make some shout out to the OGs. So the OGs that I can remember, Hagen, obviously, Becky, Ed, Thomas, Andrew Ryan, Murph, Mia, Matt Durham, Mandy McLaren, Magro, Ed again. You're on my list twice. That's course, how important you are. And there's a whole bunch of people I'm not listing that need to be on here, and I apologize. Brett Mezurek. You know who you are. I apologize for not saying it. But they showed up in the original games. They put their emails down, and they kept showing up. And we kept having 14. That was this magic number that showed up. And it's a beautiful number for baseball because it's 7-on-7 with no catcher and an extra player in the field, or not. You just have two outfielders. And what happened was is in all of the, you would have like seven at bats, six, seven, eight at bats a game, which
was awesome.
So awesome. And there was whiskey at the mound, which is important to note as well.
That what was like the original democracy.
Eric, what am I drinking sports. Again?
Oh yeah, try again.
Trains across the sea.
Trains across the sea. Great segue to the next episode. Trains and baseball.
Trains don't go across the sea.
I know. Are you sure you've got it?
Trains and baseball. Trains across the sea. They do cross. They go across Lake Pontchartrain. Anyways, back to the story. The 7-on-7. You forgot what team you're on, and you also forgot the score, and the score didn't really matter.
Oh my God, we never knew the score.
And you knew, and later in the game, you forgot what team you're on.
Yeah.
And so it didn't really matter the as far as the outcome, although it was important still to play good baseball. I want to make that clear. We were still playing hardball, wooden bats, good baseball, but it didn't really matter as far as the outcome.
Right.
And it was more about the experience. And that was sort of what was developed and, I don't know, what's the word? Like
nurtured?
Nurtured, yeah.
Yeah. I think it was a good nurturing incubation period for the league.
Yeah.
Like whiskey, a lot of running around, the weather, the field was always, you know, splashy in some parts and dusty in some parts and like...
Yeah. And
kind of a mess.
Yeah, and shout out to Front of Town. This was happening on Lafitte, Greenway. We were pirating the field, which worked out, and people were, you know, biking by and watching us play. And then we got a lot of people just from biking by. And, you know, and that sustained itself as the email list grew. And we had some really committed people early on, as mentioned earlier, or not mentioned. And... Mike Karam, did I give him Mike Karam?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, Mike Karam. You were there from the beginning, my bad. And that lasted and sustained itself throughout 2016. And ultimately in 2017, we got organized and had a draft, which is a whole other episode.
Yeah.
Real teams and uniforms and those sort. And we lost people because of that.
Well, because we had dues.
Because
$20.
$20 dues.
For baseball coverage only.
Right.
Because we wanted to play with good baseballs.
And ultimately, you know, fast forward to 2019, that's sort of what led to where we're at right now. But that, I feel like, answers the question of where this started, how it started. And Becky, do you want to add anything to that?
I think that's pretty comprehensive. Like, it's not very comprehensive, but it gives a good wash on the whole, like, how ragtag it was.
Yeah.
You know, like we would show up and you would literally just say like, hey, I'll take the field.
Yeah. I want to add that, you know, this could be a whole other podcast series, but like drunken ideas that come to fruition.
Yeah.
This is a success story for a drunken idea that came to fruition.
Yeah. Yeah. And we still have meetings at Powell's and there are still usually a section in my notes called foggy ideas, which are after we've had a little... bit too, like I found it one in my notebook the other day. It was the only thing I wrote down. It said foggy ideas, game start times at 8 after the hour.
Our message to you is go to Pals.
Yeah,
go to Pals and start dreaming of things that could be, and maybe write it down so you remember the next day, or complain about things for a couple of years. And eventually make some declarations. I don't know where this is going. The alcohol's taken over.
There's pizza. Adam's looking at the pizza.
There's all that. Anyways, thank you for listening. And that is how the People's Baseball League started. It started with a drunken idea, much like this podcast. And we're signing off.
Bye.
Okay, I'm back with Mike Parker, and he's going to tell us a little bit about the next trivia that we're having at Parlow Brewery on September 26th, Thursday, September 26th. So he's going to give us a little preview of the categories, and I believe he has a teaser question for us. So take it away, Mike.
All right, so just a quick kind of description of the structure of Trivia Night. There are four categories with four questions each. That each question will have a certain number of points, at least one, as many as five or so. And then after those four rounds of different categories, there's then a last wager round in which teams or individuals, depending on how many people show up, are allowed to wager an amount of what they've earned to that point. So that wager round can be an equalizer for someone who's behind, or it can allow someone who's way ahead to extend their lead or to not. Think of it like Jeopardy. You know, you can play it safe, or you can really go for the home run. So September 26th will be the next one, and the four categories are going to be Bill Buckner, because he died since the last one that we had. Jim Boughton, the former Yankees and Seattle Pilots pitcher, who also died. He's better known as the author of Ball 4. And he was also, later in his career, a knuckleball pitcher. So it'll be evenly split between questions about him specifically and questions about knuckleballers. So there will also be a category on the 50th anniversary. So there will be questions that directly relate to the moon landing of 1969 and directly relate to Woodstock, which happened in 1969. And then there will be a category, since we'll be late in the season, there will be a category on in-season and trading deadline deals that had relevance to the end of the season and the playoffs in their respective years. So those are the four categories with four questions each. And then the wager round question will also be an anniversary question. 2019 is the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, the riot in New York that many gay rights crusaders see as a real crucible point. And so there will be a question related to a gay baseball player.
All right, and that's at Parlo on Thursday, September 26th at 7 p.m. So study up, and I believe we have a teaser question. If you contact us, we're still figuring out how to do that, but if you know my number or email, please reach out. Contact us with an answer to this question. The first person with an answer to this question gets a beer on us at Trivia on Thursday, September 26th.
Okay, as you probably know, the team from River Ridge in the greater New Orleans area won the Little League World Series just a few days ago. So the teaser trivia question is, what current veteran Major League third baseman hit a two-run home run for the team from Willemstad, Curaçao, that won the Little League World Series in 2004? He has starred for two American League West teams over the course of a still-thriving career. Again, current veteran Major League third baseman hit a two-run home run for the Willemstad Curaçao winning Little League World Series team in 2004, and he has played for two AL West teams over the course of his career.
All right. Thank you, Mike, and we look forward to seeing all of you out there. Once again, you can contact us, the People's Baseball League at gmail.com, or if you got my number or Mike's number, find a way to contact us. Yell at us when we're driving by, biking by. All that works. Thanks a lot.